I do have consent for this interview to be uploaded by a public archive and used by Northeastern.
Thank you. So could we start by talking a little bit about your regular job and the ways in which your daily routine and responsibilities have changed since the COVID outbreak?
Sure. So my regular job is I oversee two emergency departments in New York City and also work in them as a physician. But as my job overseeing, I oversee the physician staff and then all of the operational aspects of the department, from how it works, how people work there, what they're expected to do, the financial pieces of it. And so I would say my job changed in the big picture. I'd say the biggest change was that it became my entire life for several months. That's all we did. It really started hitting New York in early March, and from early March until probably about 2 weeks ago, where it's still ongoing but has clearly slowed down. You know, this was the entire piece of, you know, day-to-day existence was really wrapped around what was happening with COVID, how it was affecting our department, our city, our staff, and how to respond to it. And also, we were trying to put out some academic work around it about what were the things that we were doing that were successful, because we had so many more patients than most people that we were able to get a sense of what was working, what was not working, and how we did it.
Right. Could you talk a little bit more about the structural changes and all of the precautions that you've had to implement?
Sure. So I oversee two sites, and both sites see somewhere between them, somewhere around 160,000 patients a year in the emergency department. And what had changed is that we went from departments that saw, you know, obviously zero COVID patients to probably about 80-90% of the patients we were seeing were COVID related. So we had to do a whole bunch of different things. And, you know, obviously it was about staff protection, just from the standpoint of PPE. So there was lots of different and honestly changing recommendations and requirements that we had to do for PPE. So there were the issues of, one, was there enough? And when we first started, you know, I don't think we ever got into the point where there wasn't enough, but we did get into the point where there were some concerns whether there would be. And we also had to change essentially how we generally responded or used it. So for example, like an N95 mask, in the past you would change it after when this happened, and until now, you know, we still use one for an entire shift. Other things around, you know, when we went from masking policies initially as we started, you know, there was a sense that it was all respiratory. And what we found very quickly is that there were lots of patients who came in with complaints that had nothing to do with coughing, et cetera, or other respiratory shortness of breath, et cetera, type issues. And so we found out very quickly that every patient had to be kind of assumed to have it, and there was asymptomatic transmission. And so we went very rapidly from, you know, if you're taking care of a patient who's coughing, you need to wear a surgical mask and you need to do an N95 if you're doing respiratory procedures, to basically every person in the emergency department who worked there was wearing N95s all the time and wearing masks all the time, or face shields all the time. And then we started also masking our patients as they came in too, because one, to prevent them from passing on, and also gave them another level of safety, I think. So there is, you know, issues around PPE, also donning and doffing, making sure people put on the proper gowns, took them off properly. And while it seems like a relatively simple thing, it's actually pretty hard to keep up and do it the right way all the time, and do it also in places that at baseline are cramped. And so, you know, it best practice may be to go in and then take it off in the room, and then wash your hands, and then move outside the room, etc. And the reality is the rooms weren't big enough, and so we had to come up with new ways and new ideas to do that. We had to change how we triage patients. We brought in a lot. We started doing a lot of telemedicine, where we would have patients sit in a chair and we would talk them through the telemedicine. We had these kind of robots we used. We also used iPads at times. And part of that was, one, was to decrease the chance that the patients could infect someone, but also to decrease the use of PPE, because if you had to gown up and glove up and everything every time you went into a room, you know, it was a huge use of limited resources. We also introduced telemedicine into the department to help consultants call in who may not have been on site, and also to help patients talk to their families who were not. At some point, we stopped having visitors and they were no longer able to come in. We changed some of the processes where patients, you know, any other day if they came to the emergency department, they'd be seen in the emergency department, but because there was such a large number of people coming in who wanted to be tested, and they weren't actually that ill, we set up alternative care sites. So we set up tents outside to do rapid testing or just evaluations. And at some point, we basically, unless you were critically ill, you just never got tested because we didn't have the test available. And some of it was owned, the only people that had it was the Department of Health, and they didn't have enough. And so it really wasn't helpful for us. And so we just basically screened people and made a decision whether they could go home or not. And we developed algorithms for screening based on a combination of some of the literature that we read in China, what was the highest risk patients, who were the lower risk patients, based on physical examination, based on their basic vital signs and their respiratory rate, their heart rate, their pulse oximeter, and if they were normal. And then we broke them down into high risk, low risk categories. And we would do follow up by video follow up from some of the higher risk patients who could go home. So, and then getting into the department itself, we started to break down things into zones of respiratory and non-respiratory zones, high risk respiratory, lower risk respiratory zones, and trying to put patients, obviously, who were higher risk into closed door rooms, but we just didn't have enough. And so we started taking over more and more parts of the emergency department. So we had a low acuity area, and we weren't in. So as we moved the lower acuity patients out to other sites, we started putting sicker patients in those areas. Our pediatric volume went to almost zero, and we took over our pediatric department and basically filled it up with beds that we were able to put admitted sick COVID patients into. So there was, you know, kind of this cascading level of operational changes that were based on changes in the science as we knew it and what was infectious, what was not infectious, changes in the volume as it increased very rapidly over a week period of time and then stayed up for a while, changes in the resources we had, and also changes in kind of how the hospital was able to build rooms and build areas and move people out of the emergency department.
That's really incredible that you were able to get all of that done so quickly.
It was a lot of ongoing. It was basically we built a lot of escalation pathways as we were doing this. And so as it first started, we would build kind of, well, if we hit this volume, this is what we do. And then if we hit this volume, this is what we do. So we would have the outline, these kind of algorithms and plans that would say, if we got to 25 patients, we would then move into this area and move these patients over. And then we built a cohort pathway saying, you know, we knew we could not get the testing back on patients being admitted for another day, but we would run out of space to put them. So we actually built in, we just submitted a paper on it of if patients have these five factors, that we think the chance of them having COVID are almost 100%. So we could start putting them together with patients who we knew had COVID because we'd run out of places to put them elsewhere.
Do you feel like anything in your training prior to the outbreak prepared you for everything that had to happen? And were you provided with any additional training, or was it really just everything in the moment?
Yeah, it's the everyday, but also you do a lot of, I would say, training and practice on how to disaster, how do you respond to an outbreak that goes on and on for a long period of time. Although we've had recently, you know, we had things like measles that had outbreaks, we had things like Ebola, and some of the plans that we've done for that, or the plans for H1N1, it's still kind of on the same idea, so we were able to dust some of them off, think about how we did that, and then just did it to, a different level.
Do you have any memorable patient experiences from the pandemic that you can share?
It was interesting. So I worked probably in the last month and a half, I think I've done about 4 or 5 shifts. You know, I can't tell you I have a specific memorable patient. I could tell you that the first shift I did when, let me think about it, when probably around, it was probably about March 25th or something like that. I don't remember the exact date. And I remember coming home thinking, I've never in 20 years worked a more horrible shift. I mean, it was so many sick people that were just so nonstop. And you couldn't move without, you know, they're just constantly coming in. They were unbelievably ill. And, you know, there's a sense of how do you even keep up? And plus, you know, you're scared yourself because you can't, you know, it was still unknown how infectious it was. We had a lot of people who worked with us who got ill early on. Lately, we really haven't, but early on, there was a lot of healthcare workers. We had doctors who were getting sick. We had our techs getting sick. We had nurses getting sick. And so there's this kind of combination of you're worried about it. Plus, you know, you're so busy just taking care of the people. And so, you know, I think there's people I remember in the sense I remember very clearly caring for them and worrying about them. And, you know, you would end up trying to call their family and talk to them who weren't there. But in some ways it all kind of ran together. It's like one after another. It was pretty overwhelming.
I can't even imagine. A lot of doctors that I've interviewed have talked about the strength and sense of community within the hospital. Could you talk a little bit about your experience with that?
You know, mine was a little bit different in the sense that I was not necessarily in the same, you know, my job is not as generally as a staff physician. And so, you know, my job was to kind of support them rather than be them, I think, in some sense. But I think there was a huge sense of the leaders across the hospital and across our, so we had within our system, our emergency medicine system, as far as the doctors were coming to work in the emergency room and help them. So I think there was a real sense of community across the leadership. I think there was the same group, you know, same sense within the staff. And I think there was this across departments too. So I think it was very clear that people were there to help each other. And it was really powerful, I think.
That's really amazing. Do you feel that unity has kind of translated in our overall society, or do you think that COVID has done more to divide us?
You know, it's hard to say. When you live in New York, you see, I think it's done more to bring people together. But when you read the newspaper and you see what goes on around the country, I think it's probably divided in some ways, or clearly is. You know, I mean, I think the newspapers probably play up certain things more than others. So it's hard to say. I think there's been, you know, without getting the politics so much, I think just on a leadership scale and a scale how you respond to pandemics, I think there's been a failure on the national government right now, and leadership in the government. And I think that has translated into less of a strong kind of national response to it. I think in New York, it's probably more homogenous from a political standpoint. And I think that it also hit the city so much harder. So I think there's a stronger response and kind of more coherent response to it.
Are there any common misconceptions that you hear either among patients or in the media about COVID?
That's a hard question in the sense that what may be a common misperception today may be the truth tomorrow. And I think one of the things that has been real difficult is that the science is so rapidly changing that it's hard to know, you know, how important some things are. I think that, you know, you hear people talk about how, well, they're never going to get it. It's kind of like the flu. I never had it before, so I'm never going to get it. That doesn't really mean a whole lot. I think people don't fully understand how deadly it can be. You know, but on the other hand, you know, for the most part, most people will do perfectly fine. And that's part of the reason why it's so deadly is that it's not like some of the previous, SARS epidemic or MERS, where if you got it, you were really sick. So it was easy to figure out who that person was, isolate that person, and you could kind of put an end to it. Same with Ebola. You know, there's not a lot of asymptomatic patients with Ebola walking around. But because it's so, it's so variable, the response to it, and some people do absolutely horrible, and most people do perfectly fine, that it really is hard to get people to all focus on the right thing or doing the right thing. And I think it's not entirely sure exactly what that right thing is. You know, are masks important? They probably are, but, you know, where do they become important? If you're in an elevator, if you're walking on the street, you know, if you're sitting in a classroom. So I think, you know, to say that I'm not doing something because, you know, I don't need it or I'm protected doesn't help, but I also think a lot of it is that people just don't know.
Right. Some of the other people I've interviewed have talked about that kind of gradual income of information, and that changing science is one of the hardest parts of treating patients at this time. Would you agree with that?
No, I would. It's a hard part of treating patients. I mean, to some extent, there's some basic stuff in treating patients, respiratory failure, et cetera, but they're a little bit different, and we're finding out things about blood clotting and inflammation that we didn't know before. So there's more things we're adding on or doing a little bit different. I think part of it is in how staff even respond and protect themselves, how patients, how you deal with families. You know, I think that's a little bit harder, I think, because it's changing so much. I do think a lot of the medical response is going to get better, and we've learned certain things, but there are still certain basic medical kind of ways of taking care of patients that probably haven't changed that much. But I think it is, early on when we really knew almost nothing, it was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
I do think there's some sense of where people need to take it seriously, and even if they don't believe that they are personally at risk, I think there is this sense that, you know, if you're not at risk, you still can put someone else who is really frail at much higher risk if you don't take these kind of precautions seriously. And that is not translated everywhere.
Definitely. And then shifting gears a little bit, obviously achieving physical health has to be a priority at this time. But can you talk about some of the mental health resources that are available to both doctors and patients?
You know, it's I can't talk enough probably or enough detail about the mental health resources to patients, because a lot of that's being done kind of as outpatients, and not necessarily in the emergency department. We have had an increase in some ways in some of our psychiatric volume, but they're available now, and so we could get people to see when they come in to the ER. From the physician standpoint, it's been interesting because there has been a tremendous amount of resources available to our doctors and to our nurses, and we've had mental health teams, and we've had opportunities, and they you know, they're on call, they're willing to do things by Zoom, they're willing to do things on phone, they're willing to call into our meetings. And what is not necessarily surprising, at least for the emergency department, and I tell you it's different than for the ER than other places in the hospital, is that almost no one has taken them up on it. And that's across nursing, across physicians, across tech. And there's a little bit of the emergency department always, I think, sees itself a little bit differently, acts a little differently, and kind of leans on each other. And I think that there's been a lot of people who have leaned on each other and help each other. And we've done things like we have, you know, people to call and you know, within our department. So, you know, you're supposed to check on a couple of people every week to see how they're doing. I personally, like every single person who went home sick with this or potentially with this, I would call them at home or just email them to make sure they're okay. But there's been a lot of opportunities, and the system does a lot of like wellness things and emails constantly, and we're doing this, we're doing this. And so there's a lot of opportunities. I don't think people have taken, at least from the ER, up on it a tremendous amount, but I think that's partly how the emergency department has always functioned, and they kind of lean on each other for support rather than go outside. But it is absolutely there, and it's being, you know, offered, pushed, and from every way, you know, from every standpoint, we make it very clear that we want people to take advantage of it.
That's good to hear. Are there any things that you feel could have been done differently to prepare for and respond to the pandemic?
You know, obviously there's things we could have done different locally. I would say the single biggest thing is the government needed to do a national kind of planned response. There was time to do it, to think about PPE, to think about pandemic planning, to think about how to do things from a systematic approach rather than a piecemeal approach. And I think that approach has led to, you know, political ways of looking at it, has led to increased death, has led to, you know, states fighting each other for limited PPE, has led to confusion. And I think if there's anything I would say is that the way the government responded to this was so poor and so it was disgraceful. Locally, I think that, you know, I guess there's probably things we could have done different. We've done a lot of like hot washes and reviews of our planning and so forth. And, you know, some of it's around communication. And some of the things I learned is that, you know, from my physician staff and also from nursing is that we would initially started sending things out once or twice a week and did every 3 weeks or so we'd do a meeting online and realize that more information is actually critical. And so we started every single week. Now we have a Zoom meeting. I'll have 50 people show up in addition to sending things out on a routine basis. And I think really keeping people in the loop of SARS communication is probably critical because it changes so much. And just sending emails doesn't cut it. You've got to be able to talk to people and answer the questions and tell them why you're doing things. And it may not be what they want to hear, but at least they're hearing it from you and making it clear that you have a real plan to what's going on.
Right. I think you've touched on this a little bit, but are there any important lessons that you feel you'll take away from working during the pandemic?
I think communication is probably my single biggest one. I think, you know, focusing on people taking care of themselves, I think is important, but I think that, And the importance of thinking systematic or system from a system-wide perspective. You can't do it all yourself, so leaning on and using and helping other people within your system to try to understand what they're doing. One of the things that we did that I actually found incredibly helpful was from just a pure medical perspective. Early on, because there was so much information out there, that people were doing things differently. So for example, I remember very early, I asked someone, you know, what's your plans with this patient? I said, oh, we're gonna admit this patient. I said, why? I said, well, the ICU attending said, if anyone has anything abnormal on their x-ray, they need to be admitted. And this is, you know, once again, no one really knew the answer. So what we decided to do is we developed clinical care plans that went from how do you triage patients when you triage to give you this is the best information as we can see it out there on how you triage, make decisions on admission, make decisions on labs, what do these labs mean for all our staff. And so I think trying to take the variability out of the treatment and being able to say this, you know, it may not be 100% right, but everyone's doing it the same way. And then if it isn't right, we'll change it at the same time rather than everyone doing something different. And I think that was really helpful for us to, one, understand what everyone's doing, two, allow us to plan our resource management. Because if we know all our lower acuity patients are getting chest x-rays, I may need another machine out in my tent. If we know that no one is, then I don't. And so I think having kind of consistency along what we do made a huge difference. And that's, you know, really was a great learning, you know, of what worked for me.
That's really incredible that you could maintain that much communication and organization within all of the chaos that I can't even imagine what is going on in the hospitals in New York right now.
Yeah, it's really calmed down now, but it was tough for it was probably about 2 or 3 weeks between our sites. You know, we admitted probably so I have some numbers. I have some idea to just give you. Give me 1 second. But between our sites, we admitted somewhere around 1,800 or 1,700 patients between early March and currently. At the peak, there was about 200 to 300 in each of the hospitals with COVID. So it was pretty busy, you know, and that's the ones just getting admitted. And if you think about the disease itself, you know, only a small percentage get admitted. So there's some pretty sick patients. And I think the about 20%, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 20% of them died. So it was a pretty sick population of people. So yeah, it was busy. But it was actually, by doing, you know, kind of making things as consistent as possible, made it a lot easier for us to function.
I'm sure. All right. Well, those are all of the questions that I had written down. I've just been asking at the end, is there anything else that you would have liked to talk about related to COVID or anything that I could have done differently or better?
No, I think you asked all the, you know, the highlights, you know, what we did, why we did it, how we did it, how it could have been better, and what we took home from it. I think those are together, and how do we maintain a volume that allows us to function, but also do it in a way that's safe for people. And I think we're all struggling with that right now. And the infrastructure improvements are probably more costly than anyone has the ability to fix right now, especially now with the economy. So I think we're all trying to think about moving forward, you know, what's the new model, whether it's a business model, whether it's a clinical model, whether it's a combination, you know, how are we going to do this in the safest way possible?